and welcome to Redefining Outbound, a podcast series for sales leaders. I'm one of your hosts, Frida Odesson, VP of US Sales at Cognizant. I'll be interviewing a range of forward-thinking sales leaders on how and why B2B buying behavior has changed, and we'll be unpacking why these trends are important for outbound. I hope you enjoy the episode.
All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to yet another episode of Redefining Outbound. I'm here today with Kevin Gaitner, KG, also known as CRO and founder of Inside Sales Expert. Kevin, great to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Hi, Frida. Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to participating in the show and hopefully helping out your listeners a little bit.
All right. Awesome. Yeah, I'm super excited to chat today. Before we dive in, do you mind introducing yourselves to the listeners? Who are you?
Absolutely. No problem whatsoever. So I have been in sales and sales leadership since 1994. Frida, that makes me old. But what's important is that nobody ever said that I should be in sales. No one ever said, you've got the gift of gab. You know, I can talk to anybody. No one ever said that to me, Frida. As a result, I basically had to spend my entire career learning how to sell and learning how to lead from scratch. And that actually served me right because I didn't have any bad habits or predispositions, you know, going into my sales and sales leadership career. And I'm pleased to report that, you know, after nearly 30 years and being at 8 startups where I built sales teams, 3 of those have had exits. And now because of those successful exits and liquidity events, my wife and I don't have to take W-2 jobs ever again if we don't have to. And that's all to say that I've had success through tons and tons of mistakes and economies that have gone up and down like we're going through now. And now I spend my time through my through Inside Sales Expert, my company, in helping others avoid the mistakes that I've made over the last 30 years in building, fixing, and growing sales teams. And I've made more mistakes, Frida, than I have had successes. But all of those mistakes have led to my success.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's so fun. And I think someone who might not be as quote unquote old, but someone that's done a lot of startups in my life, I think like when times have been harder, that's when you learn the most and develop the most. So I'm super excited to dive in today. We're going to talk a little bit about, you know, your experience of managing teams through crisis, things like that, meltdowns, et cetera. But before we dive in, a little warm-up question to you that I ask on every single episode. What does the concept of redefining outbound mean to you?
That is a fluid definition. That was a fluid definition for me. And certainly what redefining outbound means is almost as literal as the phrase is itself. The fact of the matter is, well, first of all, Frida, if anybody ever says to you and any of your listeners, cold calling doesn't work, cold calling is dead, you can be sure they're going to be selling you something, okay? The fact of the matter is that cold calling does not work as effectively as it used to, and emails don't work as effectively as they used to. But redefining outbound means what worked a year ago, 2 years ago, means we need to change it, you know, change it now. And I can tell you that great sales leaders take opportunities like this to experiment and try new things, tactics, process, people, whatever that might be. And I have a firm belief, and we can expand on this later. I have a firm belief that what's old is new again. And sales leaders today should be spending, in addition to cold calling, cold emailing, and other tactics and strategies that they're using to reach their target audience, should be 1000% leaning into networking. I'm calling it networking because I'm old. But some people are calling it nearbound. You know, they're coming up with all these, you know, it's not inbound and it's not outbound, but it's nearbound. Fine. Whatever it is you call it, your network. I don't care if you've been in business for 2 years as an SDR or 15 years as a hunting AE selling enterprise products. Your network is bigger than you think it is at any size company that you could be at, because in theory, everybody has at least 120 connections. And when you start compounding that, I mean, Frida, how many people are in your company?
550, I believe.
550 people. Each one of them probably knows 120 people each. Imagine the reach that that audience can have. And yet very few sales leaders reach out to an engineer in their company and go, hey, we're trying to get into this target account. It looks like you know four people that are related to this company in some way. Can you help make an introduction? What's old is new again. And we're just, I think that that is, in terms of redefining outbound, it's not what didn't work then we should just kill. It's a matter of redoing things that we've done in the past, do it differently, and try and test and incorporate new things. That's what redefining outbound means to me.
Love that. So like almost going back to the Rolodex, but like in a more modern way is what I'm hearing.
You said Rolodex. I'm the one who's supposed to be old on this one.
Yes. I love that. I don't think anyone's mentioned this before, and Rolodex definitely has not come up. So I love it. And so with that in mind, like, what do you think is a challenge that most sales leaders are facing right now?
Yeah. So this is my business. I consult with CEOs, founders, heads of sales of pre-IPO tech companies, and generating high quality top of funnel pipeline. And I'm saying high quality top of funnel pipeline is the number one issue. There's so many tools out there that focus on like coaching for sales. Okay. So we're in a deal and we're in a conversation with a prospect, you know, all this, these AI generate, you know, AI tools. I think that's not nearly as important as top of, you can't have the second piece if you can't have high quality, you know, top of funnel. So how am I supposed to go into 2024 or the second half of 2024 if I'm not focusing on, you know, top of funnel? So that is number one. Number two, I was literally at the bar on Friday night, and a sales leader that I was talking with said, I've got a CEO who's telling me that I can't hire anymore, but I have to grow. So this do more with less. So this is the second challenge. Do more with less becomes this like, and it's unfathomable for many sales leaders who all their experience occurred from 2010 and beyond. They don't have any sales leadership experience before 2010. And there's a lot of people that fall into this category where it's like, just grow. Money's easy to have. Fine. Now it's, this is how much money we have. We need to grow and do more with less. So that is the second biggest issue. And I think related to that is this like rude awakening of growth at all cost versus growth with low cost. And it's a very similar to number two. But so if we could just narrow it down to those two, top of funnel, pipeline generation, quality pipeline generation, along with do more with less. I can't buy a bunch of tools any longer and think that's going to solve my problems. So I feel like those are the most acute that what my clients are telling me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's like super spot on based on what we're seeing right now. I'm curious, like what triggered this whole growth with low costs, like the shift from growth at all costs to grow with low cost movement? Like, can we pinpoint that to like a certain trigger?
Oh, it's easy. The, you know, VC funding just collapsed. It just absolutely collapsed. Those investments aren't as easy. So you couple, you know, it's high interest rates. Okay. So we've had, you know, an economy that's been, you know, we've been printing money and money is loose and inflation goes absolutely, you know, haywire. As a result, the Fed goes and raises interest rates. So it becomes incredibly difficult to borrow, you know, to borrow money. Then with these fear, you know, the economic uncertainties, global uncertainties that we're dealing with, and, you know, everybody knows this, you know, a year and a half ago or whatever, it's like the Ukraine war breaks out and all hell breaks loose with VC funding. It's just like, it shrunk so quickly. I had a client, a VC client, who hired a couple of salespeople through me, And literally like 6 weeks later, the economy had turned, the VC market turned so quickly, and they laid off both of them. So when you put those two things together, borrowing money is unbelievably expensive. And then VC money is just not nearly as fluid as it used to be. Those two things combined have created this, do more with less, because my clients are basically saying, okay, I've got a burn rate, and then I've got this amount of money. I've only got 18 months of cash left in the bank, and their board, their VCs are telling them, don't plan on being able to raise more money. And you put all those things together, and a sales leader is like, okay, wait, can I hire salespeople? Can I train my salespeople? Can I buy tools? Can I hire support? You know, I don't know what I can do any longer, because it was free flowing before. And now everyone has to be very fiscally responsible. And that's not what many sales leaders are used to, especially if their sales leadership career began in 2010 and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super interesting. And that actually leads me, it's a great segue into my next question that I want to talk to you about today, because as your own words, you're quote unquote old. You were here during the economic downturn we faced back in 2008. There are a lot of similarities with what we're going through now. Yes. I think also you wrote a super interesting LinkedIn post about this. But can you walk me through, like, what are the similarities and what now versus then, and what types of like leadership, what type of leader does it take to manage a team or a company through this?
Yeah. For sure. And I also led sales teams through the dot-com bubble bursting back in 2000, 2001 as well. Again, yes, I'm old. So through that age though, comes these kinds of experiences. And most recently being the mortgage meltdown and economic crisis that we faced at that time. And just like what we're dealing with now, it happened just like that. It happened so fast in a matter of months. It went from printing money and orders are coming in very, very easily. And we didn't really have to sell that aggressively or be that disciplined in our selling, to committee buys, even for small purchases where it's like, oh my gosh, there's like 10 people involved for a $10,000 purchase. Like just, absolutely, crazy. And what I'm observing is really two types of leaders right now. One is the type of leader that, is like they want to play the victim. Woe is me. Everything is unfair. And it's like no one writes, Frida, think about the last time you heard a story about a success story about somebody who continually played the victim but did nothing about it. Like they took no actions. Like that doesn't even exist. That doesn't even exist. And so that leads me then to the next sales leader. And the next sales leader, the one that's going to be successful now and through every success and downturn moving forward, is the one that's going to simply say, we can't just keep doing what we're doing. We have to make changes, dramatic changes, difficult changes to the sales team. And if you're more concerned, and this is going to sound awful, if you're more concerned about disrupting the culture on your sales team, you're missing the big picture, because it could be kumbaya, lovely. Everyone loves to work for this sales leader, and yet you're not doing very well. And the company is going to make a decision fiscally for you if you're not a part of making these changes. What does that mean? The sales leader is going to get fired. Their salespeople are going to get fired. They're going to get laid off. And everyone thinks it's so unfair. It's what happens. You haven't been through it before. So when you haven't been through it before, it sounds like such a travesty and it's awful. So anyway, let me stop. And anything you want to ask further about that? So my point is like, don't play the victim. Okay, there's plenty of sales leaders out there. They're going to be like, oh, woe is me. And it's just not fair. And corporations are blah, blah, blah. Like what? No, the sales leaders that are going to be successful is, this is the world I live in now. I need to make changes from what we did before and for the future. And that means testing and trying new things. And that is hard. That is really, really hard. I've done it. It's really, really difficult. Sometimes you win. Sometimes you lose. Sometimes you get your butt handed to you. Before we go on, any questions, comments, concerns, or anything you want me to dive into deeper?
No, I think that makes total sense. Like, maybe hearing from there, like, how did you solve this in 2008? Like, what did you actually do?
Yes.
Because that sounds great and all. And it's like, sounds easy when you save, but like, how do you actually get there? Right.
Sidebar. There are so many people out there that publish on LinkedIn that really don't know their butt from their elbow about any of this stuff. And they could say all the things that I just said. Okay. I'm really pleased and happy that you've called me out on that to go, great, all sounds well and good, but like, what can our listeners take away from this? What I observed was two things. My sales process didn't fit the current buying environment. Here's something for any sales leader to tattoo on their left arm. The best sales process mirrors the buying process. Okay. And so we had to revamp our entire sales methodology and sales process. Anybody knows there's a difference between the sales methodology and sales process. Some people mix those two things together and think it's the same thing. It's not. Okay. A sales methodology is a belief system. Okay. Here's what we believe in. This is how we believe we're treating our customers, you know, customer centric selling or, you know, things like that. And then the process are the linked and sequential steps that flow from that value system, flow from that philosophy. And what I ended up doing that was very successful was to implement high probability selling. Most people have no idea what that is. There's a book by Jacques Wirth called High Probability Selling. Somebody else had recommended it to me, Frida, and it was an absolute game changer. And the central premise is this. We really only want to be doing business with the people that can, one, want our product, need our product, can afford our product, and want to buy that product in a relatively short period of time. Okay, those four things. Let me say that again. High probability selling is about identifying prospects that want your product, need your product, can afford your product, and want to buy your product in a relatively short period of time. Do you know the difference between want and need, Frida?
Could be big. Yeah.
Yeah. Could be really big. Let me just put it to you this way. I'm a little bit overweight. You know why? Because I need salad, but I want pizza. I need salad, but I want pizza. The want is far more compelling than the need. And as it's easy for people to understand that oftentimes people need to do something for themselves or for their company, but they just don't want to do it. So there's a big difference between those two. There's no need for us to be cagey about what our product costs. Hey, based on what I'm hearing, it probably is going to look like this. Let's not waste time with people that are going to be like, oh my gosh, that's like way out of our range, way out of our budget. And then of course, relatively short period of time. You keep pushing these opportunities because you haven't, you know, quarter after quarter, they just keep pushing because you really haven't figured out that like, this is something that they need to solve right now. It's a major initiative. They want to solve it. It's on the objectives for 2024. So I did that way back when, and it was an absolute game changer. But the second thing, so one, evaluate your sales methodology and your sales process. Does that suit the buyer of today? Okay, so that's number one. Number two, do you have the right butts in the seat? This sounds so trite. It sounds so obvious, but we spent a significant amount of time. And when I say we, it was myself and several of my sales managers in this project to evaluate and answer this one simple question. If the job could speak to me objectively in today's environment, what would it tell me it needs for superior performance today? That's different than saying, here are our top salespeople, let's clone them. That's not the same thing. I'm trying to build a sales team that is meant to be successful in this environment with our, you know, the economy the way it is, the sales methodology and process that we've laid out. And the sad story that I tell with this is when I implemented, when I did that exercise and did those two things, new hiring process, new hiring benchmark, as well as the new sales methodology and sales process, Frida. By the end of the year, I had turned over 100% of my sales team. I am not proud of that. And I can tell you that, and I fall on the sword and go, there's probably 1,000 more things that I could have done to save a lot more of those salespeople. But it didn't. It is what it is. And again, I feel bad about it because I don't, it's not like something that I want to do. No one wants to be firing people and laying them off. But literally turned over 100% of my sales team. That being said, the people that came on, they bought into the, they fit the benchmark, the hiring benchmark. They bought into the sales methodology and the sales process, and the metrics continued, even in the downturn, the metrics continued to go up and to the right. And that's what it takes to be successful in a downturn like this. You could, you know, read a bunch of stuff from so-called gurus and experts out there, Frida. And they talk about, you know, push back on the founder and these goals are too high and all this kind of stuff. You're going to get your ass handed to you. You know, the founder and the CEO, they're just going to go, all right, then you're not the person for the job. And you're making my life miserable. And I'm not looking for people to just say yes to me and agree with me. But if your big solution is to lower goals, which means less profitability for the company, you're missing the point. You're not going to be there for the long haul. So, but those are some of the two, like it was both strategic and tactical. I made decisions about butts in the seat and our sales methodology, and then made those changes and implemented those changes. And I feel firmly, strongly that any sales leader should be doing that very thing right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. That's like such an impactful sort of learning that you had to go through that definitely fits in. Like, you know, we're seeing the same movie again right now.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. And look, if you don't make changes, they're going to hire somebody new, a new head of sales, because that new head of change needs to happen. You can't just keep doing the same thing. It sounds obvious, but it becomes easy for weak leaders to go, well, I'm more concerned about the culture of my sales team. I don't want to disrupt the culture. You know what that means? You're more worried about the salespeople liking you than you are about the success of the company. Those two things can exist. They can exist. But if you're just focused on, you know, doing the things that make salespeople happy, You're not going to get promoted. You're not going to, you know, move on to good success if you can't make those tough decisions and changes. So, enough of that.
Is there, in your opinion, such thing as pivoting too quickly?
For sure. Yes. yeah, you're probably going to lead us right into another, you know, topic that I've become increasingly, passionate about. There's this god-awful phrase that I don't even know when it started, but it's been in existence for, I don't know, 10, 15 years more. Run fast and break stuff. Have you heard this one before, Frida? Run fast and break stuff. This is like, you know, pre-IPO, you know, fast growing company. That's this mantra that these VCs have, like, you know, laid onto these founders. And the idea is sound in and of itself. The execution can get lost. And I've learned this, you know, the hard way. So, for example, great, stuff's not working. Let's change. And the mistakes that I see very frequently is they change so fast that they don't, one, set up process, policies, and it doesn't take that long. So what I say is run fast and break stuff is great. But if you're on a well-oiled track, like you've laid down a well-oiled track, you could run far faster than in a pile of dirt, you know, or sand, okay? And so oftentimes sales leaders themselves or compelled by the board or by the CEO to just make sort of knee-jerk changes, especially to compensation, by the way, without thinking through the consequences of this. Is this a two-way door or is this a one-way door? You know, we make this decision. Can we roll it back? Okay. And here's another one. Making a change with no like expected result. I learned at ZipRecruiter to call your shot. If you're going to make a change, and we believed in running fast and breaking stuff, no doubt about it. But every leader from product to marketing to sales was forced to define a metric for success. So I'm going to make this change. I'm going to run this contest. I'm going to change the comp plan. I'm going to implement new technology. But I'm going to define what the metric for success is. And I'm going to define how we measure that over the period of this test, which then also leads me to the next issue in changing too fast. You tried it and you get a week down the line. Of course, you didn't define what metrics for success were. You didn't define benchmarks or whatever. And then you're going, okay, so is it working? Okay, no. Okay, great. Let's go do something else. If you're not taking the time to go to like, what are the policies, process, what are the resources that are needed? Just a little extra time, Frida. It's not like, let's spend 2 weeks on this. I mean, like a few extra days to really think through resources and process and all the kinds of things that we need for it to be successful, defining what it looks like, and then go, great. After a week, we're going to look at the metrics and we're going to look to see what that looks like. We're going to, you know, this thing is going to be a 30-day test, a 90-day test with go, no, go along the way and red light, yellow light, green light, all that kind of stuff there. But the change for change sake, that's just frenetic. That's untenable, Frida. That's untenable. Because you know what? Your salespeople are not going to stop and start just the way you think that they are. They're not going to stop and start just like that. And change is really difficult. And so if you live in this world that's constantly like, this sounds strange coming from somebody who's been at built sales teams, 8 startups, by the way. But if you're living in this world where it's like, I don't know what's happening next week, you're just going to start to doubt the validity of these changes. So there's no question that you can be changing too quickly when you're not thoughtful about how you make those changes. But we should, but we need to be thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely like a balance there, right? And I think this actually leads me perfectly into the next question, which is about sort of the main driver or the purpose for your company, Insight Sales Expert, which is helping early stage US tech companies sort of avoid all these mistakes that we're talking about. In your opinion or in your experience, aside from what we already talked about, like what are some common sort of mistakes you see sales leaders do or go-to-market leaders do in early stage companies?
Yeah. I have Scott Lees to thank for this. I don't know if you know, but many of your leaders or listeners probably know Scott Lees. I have him to thank for this revelation. He asked me one time, hey, KG, when you're building a sales team, what's the first hire that you make? And it was, you know, and I said, well, depending on the hire, it's maybe an SDR or an AE or something like that. And he goes, you know what my number one first hire would be? A RevOps person. And I was like, what? You know, aren't RevOps people there to sort of borrow your watch to tell you the time, like, you know, glorified, you know, consultants? But then I had the opportunity at ZipRecruiter after being at all these companies, all these startups where we didn't have those resources. We didn't believe in RevOps. We believed, you know, these companies that I was at before, Frida, it was RevOps are just sort of the people that configure Salesforce or HubSpot. You know, they're not really strategic partners. They don't help you get stuff done. And thankfully, towards the later years at ZipRecruiter, I learned the amazing value that a RevOps partner or a sales ops partner can have in getting to the next level and improving your conversion rates, because that team is there to help identify, you know, the data and the insights that the sales leader is probably not that good at identifying. But then their key is beyond data and insights, the RevOps leader then is able to say, And here's the recommended actions that we should take from this. And for me, I've over the years, I've so struggled with this hire, because it's easy for me to think about a salesperson that I pay $100,000 with a quota of $500,000. It's easy to understand the ROI there. Okay. $100,000, $500,000. And even if they come at 75% to that, I'm still making an ROI on that hire, Frida. RevOps hires, my word, how am I supposed to attribute the cost? And they're getting more and more expensive these days. How am I supposed to attribute the ROI to that particular cost? And it's unbelievably difficult to accomplish that attribution. So one of the biggest mistakes that I've seen, and when I advise, you know, these early stage tech companies, do yourself a favor, invest in RevOps and this is all about run fast and break stuff. But you can run faster when you have a well-seasoned track and not just a pile of sand to run in. Your RevOps leader can help you run faster on a nicer track. They'll be able to track the data, provide you insights, and help define those recommended actions, which could be those changes that you recommend. And then we go, yeah, we should change this. Great. And then RevOps goes back and they do the things. They reconfigure Salesforce, come up with a new enablement program, develop all the resources and the one sheets that go along with it and the technology to support that and all this kind of great stuff. That's what a great RevOps leader, and I'm convinced that if we're trying to do more with less these days, RevOps is for sure your answer. And adjacent to that, by the way, the advent of outsourced RevOps, it's becoming a thing. Because the other mistake that when people take my advice, they go, great, who should I hire? They're looking to make one hire. And that is also a mistake. Why? Because it's very difficult to find a RevOps leader that is both strategic and tactical enough that they want to configure Salesforce or HubSpot. Okay. Those two people typically don't exist. You want the strategy, but you want the tactics. So as a result, almost all of these outsourced RevOps companies, Frida, their pitch sounds like this: hire an entire RevOps team for the price of one full-time RevOps employee that you would hire. It's a great stepping stone to then building out the team yourself. So there's companies like Rev Partners as an example, and Jen Igartua's company. I can't remember the name of her company. There's several of these companies that are out there that for the price of one full-time RevOps hire, you get the entire team on a contract basis that you could cut off anytime if you needed. If they weren't any good, you could cut them off and go find somebody else. So that's number one, RevOps. You want to expand on that, or you want me to go to the next one?
No, that's perfect. Sounds like hire RevOps early and hire the right RevOps. Set it up correctly.
Yep, perfect. Then the next is, and this is unfortunate, but defining what it takes to get fired and defining for sales teams and defining what it takes to get promoted. It sounds awful. And I actually had a salesperson come to me and go, why do you put what it takes to get fired into the commission plan? That's just inappropriate. Like, she was pissed. Like, she was offended, okay, by this. Everybody else understood. And this was, if you say to your sales team, hey, what does it take to get fired around here? They're taken back by it, but they're already thinking it anyway. They're wondering, is it 99% to goal? Is it 50% to goal? Is it 30% to goal? Is it two quarters in a row? Is it three out of four quarters? Who knows? And you know why that's a problem? Because it creates stress. And when you've got a team that is in that is lacking in security, not that job security actually exists, but like when they're constantly like, am I going to get fired tomorrow because I'm at 98% to goal or at 80% to goal? Am I going to get fired tomorrow? That lack of security prevents your sales team from getting to the next level. Furthermore, define what it takes to get promoted. And I know that sounds strange, like, you know, well, you know, top producers get promoted, right? But objectively, what does that look like? Okay. And the other reason why that's a good thing is because there are some people that are going to pound their chests about how great they are. and continue to stick their hand out and ask for promotions. And then there's some people that are not as inclined to do that. And yet they could be objectively just as high of a performer, but they're just afraid to ask. And I've seen this exist with women in sales. They're badasses and they sell their asses off, but they're not the ones that are going to pound their chest and ask for promotions. And if you don't define that, you're going to find yourself in a position where you promote the, you know, the white male who's performing just as well as the female. The female is going to be like, screw this, I'm out of here. This is not a place to be. So define what it takes to get fired, but then define what it takes to get promoted. I hope to God this doesn't happen for your other, you know, for some of your listeners. Have you defined the quota in writing? Is there a document that you're delivering to your salespeople, even if it's an email saying your quota is this, reply saying that you've gotten it, okay? There are several of my clients that I took over. They have sales teams, 10 people, and they've defined a commission plan. If you sell this, you get paid that. But you haven't defined a quota. So I put that sort of third on the list because I, strangely enough, I see that from time to time where quotas have not been specifically defined. The comp plan, the commission plan has, but the quota hasn't. And then the fourth one, which I feel like I'm beating a dead horse a little bit, is a clear hiring process, especially today. The hires that you make, they're expensive hires. They're also very expensive when you make a mishire. This is research. This isn't just me. The cost of a mishire is 3 to 5 times base salary. Average base salaries for a hunting AE now in software as a service is like $90,000. Okay. So if you screw up one of those hires, that could be up to $500,000 of lost revenues. What? Like if you actually made a mistake on your sales team, Frida, and you cost the team $500,000, you'd think there'd be some splaining to do, wouldn't you? Like you'd have to explain why you screwed up. And yet sales leaders aren't held accountable to improving their hiring process when every mishire that they make costs 3 to 5 times base salary. These are $300,000 to $500,000 mistakes. And if you're hiring 10 people and five of them don't work out, that math adds up really, really quickly. And so having a very intentional hiring process, especially in a down economy where do more with less, every hire is critically, you know, important that you get right. Some of these founders are way too involved, and I'll just, you know, for the purposes of speeding up our conversation, you have to envision a world where you got hit by a bus tomorrow. And whether you're a sales manager, a VP of sales, or the CEO, if you got hit by a bus tomorrow and the business falters, it doesn't work as well as it did with you there overseeing everything, that is a huge problem. And my recommendation is quite simple. Go take a week vacation. Tell everybody that they cannot reach out to you at all, unless it's an absolute like roof on fire emergency. And then come back and figure out what went wrong. Well, you weren't here, so this didn't happen. You weren't here, we couldn't make a decision on this. You weren't here, da-da-da-da-da. And solve all those problems so that you remove yourself, you know, from the equation. That's true. That's true scale. So those are, what is that, five things, you know? There's so many more, but those are the five main things that I'm seeing I just got off a call with a client. Just now, the CEO is way too involved, hired a director, but wouldn't let the director do what she should have done, fired her, you know, and of course, guess what? When the cat is away, the mice play and everything falls apart. That's just a bad, that's literally today. Literally today, that was a conversation.
Yeah, that's funny. I always tell my team, a sales team is only as good as when their leader is on vacation.
I love that. Exactly. Oh my gosh. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for yes anding me.
Yeah, I say that and then I peace out on vacation and, you know, see what happens. I love it.
I love that.
Awesome. This has been super, super interesting. I know we're coming up on time. We have a few more minutes left. We can probably like make a 5-hour episode out of this, but we're not going to. One last question for you today. There's a super interesting, another interesting LinkedIn post where you talked about perceived benefit being greater than cost. I'd love if you can just like in like 60 seconds, I'm giving you a hard task here, but in 60 seconds or so, can you just like expand on this? Because I feel like there are so many salespeople and even sales leaders out there that are not getting this, right? Mm-hmm.
That's right. It's a simple, what I posted was, Frida, was an equation, okay? Value equals perceived benefit over perceived cost. Excuse me, perceived benefit. If you're not diving into cost of inaction, the pain that these people feel, and you very specifically quantify what their problems are, okay, you're missing out on the top part of the equation. And then of course the cost being their reputational cost. Okay, like I'm gonna stick my neck out. That's difficult. If I don't do anything, you know, I'm staying up till midnight three nights a week, you know. And what you ultimately want to be getting to is a scenario where you've done such a good job of identifying the value of your product and the cost it takes to implement that product, so that is greater than one, and that way greater than one. And you can go to the customer or the prospect and say, for the low, low price of $5 million over 3 years, I can absolutely solve your $20 million problem. It's super, super simple, but you can't get to that equation. Value equals perceived benefit over cost. It better be way greater than one. Okay. You can't get there if you don't identify what the perceived benefit is using their own metrics. If we move this metric, we get this many more conversions and this much more revenue. And then the cost needs to be as low as possible to then achieve that formulaic display of value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, love that. Why do you think this is so hard for salespeople?
A lot of it has to do with training. I put it all on the sales leader. Because one, you might not be putting the right butts in the seat. Two, you're not training and coaching them, you know, properly. Look, if you've got a defined, you better have a defined discovery process, the questions that we're going to ask. But if you have salespeople that just view that as a check the box, I asked the question, great, then you're doing entirely wrong. Your coaching sucks. Your coaching clearly sucks if you don't teach your salespeople how to peel back the envelope or the onion and start diving into like real pain questions. There's some people that hate that, some people that love it. I'm a huge believer in the Sandler selling process, and that pain funnel is a game changer if you can coach your salespeople to truly ask those questions and dig into real pains and be comfortable to walk away from a deal where the pain isn't really great, or the prospect is just cagey with you and it's like, ah, that's none of your business, I'm not telling you, that kind of stuff. That's walk away.
Perfect. All right. So at the end of each episode, I normally ask, what is something you recommend sales leader to start, stop, and continue doing? But I think it's been crystal clear throughout this entire episode for anyone that's been paying attention and listening. They should know, if they've been paying attention, exactly what they should, you know, start, stop, continue doing. So thank you so much, Kevin, for coming on the podcast. This was a super interesting chat. And yeah, thanks for being on.
Great. Thanks for having me.